Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Hi, friends. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. This is another special episode with Israel Wayne, where he discusses the great need for revival in our homes. Parents, are you investing the necessary time and effort in training up your children in the fear and admonition of the Lord? Let me speak to grandparents today as well, because Kathy and I are grandparents to five now. We simply must teach our grandchildren what the Bible says from cover to cover. I pray you will be encouraged to do that today. God bless you, and thank you for listening.
So I want to give you kind of a 30,000-foot view of where we are at as a Christian evangelical church culture in passing on the Christian faith to the next generation. And one of the things I want to start with is a survey that has been done for, I believe, over 20 years by George Barna. George Barna is the nation's leading researcher of all things evangelical. And he has this survey of eight questions that he asks, or in this case, eight statements, essentially. But he asks people to affirm these statements, and he asks, do you believe and affirm these statements? And I'm going to read them to you because I want you to think about them and evaluate them for yourself in terms of your own beliefs and your own worldview, and see if you would agree with and affirm these statements. So I'll start with number one, absolute moral truths exist. That means that there are some things that are morally right and some things that are morally wrong for all people and all places at all times. This is point number one. Now, point number two narrows it in a little bit and says, moral truth is defined by God in the Bible. So there are some people who say, yeah, there's right and wrong, but you know, I think it's defined by each individual. That's called individual ethics or relativism, that there is no absolute truth, but that truth is shifting based on what each person thinks or believes. Some people say, well, I think there's right and wrong, but it's determined by what the majority of people in a particular place at a particular time say it is. And that's cultural relativism. In fact, I was years ago, this will be hard for you to believe, but I was getting a haircut. And I was at a barbershop and was talking with the barber, and somehow the topic of abortion came up. And he said, well, you know, I think abortion might be wrong for certain societies, but not for other societies. Like in China, for example, you know, I don't see how we can say that they're wrong for having abortion in their country. I mean, who are we to say what they do? Or maybe at a certain time and place, it might be wrong, but maybe in 10 years or 15 years, maybe it won't be wrong anymore. That's cultural relativism. So he narrows it in and says moral truth is defined by God in the Bible. Number three, the Bible is totally accurate in all the principles that it teaches. And I like how that is worded because I think it avoids some of the traps that liberals sometimes place with the Bible. Sometimes people will ask, do you believe the Bible is true in everything that it says? And I always say I believe the Bible is true in the principles that it affirms. For example, I one time saw a bumper sticker as I was driving, and it said, "There is no God," and then it had a Bible verse underneath it. And I thought, well, I don't think the Bible says there is no God. That's ridiculous. But I looked it up, and it's actually in the Bible. The Bible itself actually says in one verse, there is no God. The problem is you have to read it in context. In context, what it says is the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So the context of what the Bible actually teaches and affirms is true. But when you pull things out of context, sometimes you can twist it. So I like how this is worded. The Bible is totally accurate in all the principles that it teaches. Number four, Jesus Christ lived a sinless life during his ministry on earth. Number five, God created the universe and continues to rule it today. He is omnipotent and omniscient. That means that he is all-powerful and he is all-knowing. Salvation is a gift from God. It cannot be earned through good works or behavior. That's number six. Number seven, Satan is a real entity. Number eight, Christians have an obligation to share the gospel with the unsaved. Now, in case you're uncertain with the pop quiz here, what the answers to these questions might be, I'm going to go ahead and give you a little tip. You should be able to affirm all eight of these statements really easily. None of these things are at all controversial if you adhere to a basic evangelical Christian statement of faith. Really, anyone who is a born-again Christian should be able to readily affirm all eight of these statements without hesitation. Now, George Barna, though, says if you affirm all eight of these statements, you have a biblical worldview. Now, a biblical worldview kind of needs defined a little bit. What does that mean? Well, a worldview is not what you believe. It's not a theology. It's not a philosophy. It's not a collection of beliefs or ideas. A worldview is a perception. It's a way of seeing life and reality. We use the analogy of sunglasses. You know, if you had on a pair of blue sunglasses and you saw through these blue lenses, everything you saw would be blue. So if you saw a white piece of paper, that white piece of paper would look blue to you because that's your perception. That's your worldview. And so a worldview is like a set of lenses through which you see life and reality. It's not a systematic theology. It's not a set of doctrines that you hold to or beliefs to which you adhere. It's the way that you see and the way that you interpret life. A biblical worldview means that you have an understanding of Scripture that informs the way that you see and understand all of life. So if we're talking about ethics, if we're talking about economics, education, religion, social issues, any kind of discussion we may be having, whether it's social justice or abortion or homosexuality, whatever the topic is, if you have a biblical worldview, your understanding of Scripture is informing the way that you think about those topics and those issues and those discussions. I think another way we could put it would be that having a biblical worldview would be seeing the world the way that God does. You know, if you could see the world through God's eyes, which is always perfect, which is always the correct view, that would be having a biblical worldview. So I have some contention, even though I agree with all of these points, I have some contention with George Barna saying, if you affirm these eight very basic statements, you have a biblical worldview. I think the bar is set a little bit too low, if that's the standard, because this is not very rigorous. I mean, this is just almost basic entry-level Christian statement of belief. It's a good assessment, but I wouldn't say you have a biblical worldview. But with that caveat, let's look at some statistics here. Only 9% of American adults will affirm all eight of those statements. Only 2% of Catholics will. Only 4% of Democrats. And this is the one that I think is the most shocking. Only 51% of pastors in the United States will affirm all eight of those statements. I travel around the country a lot, and I hear from people who say, we're having a very difficult time finding a Bible-teaching church in my area. And I'll be honest, most of the time I'm a little bit skeptical. And I go, yeah, well, you know, maybe you should get out the phone book and look. You know what I mean? I mean, that's kind of just my bias. I'm like, well, maybe you just haven't tried. And sometimes I'll actually, while we're talking, I'll say, okay, give me your zip code. And I'll pull it up and I'll look on Google and I'll be like, okay, you know, here's something transgender United Methodist, and here's something else, you know, First Church of the Mystical Spiritual, and here's, and you know, and I go through and I'm like, you know what? You actually don't have any Bible believing, Bible teaching churches anywhere in your area. And so it's true for some people that, I mean, if only 51% of pastors in the United States will affirm all eight of those statements, that says a lot about the condition of the church. The denomination that affirms those statements the most is the Southern Baptist Convention. More than any other denomination, Southern Baptist pastors affirm this. However, only 71% of Southern Baptist pastors will affirm all eight of those statements. So while that seems high compared to everything else on this list, what I think about in my mind is that means 29% of all Southern Baptist pastors have a problem with something on that list. So what is it that 29% of Southern Baptist pastors can't sign off on here? Like, they don't believe absolute moral truths exist. They don't think truth is defined by God in the Bible. They think the Bible is full of mistakes, that Jesus sinned when he was living on earth, that maybe God didn't create everything, or salvation's not a gift from God. I mean, Satan doesn't exist, or maybe they think that Christians shouldn't share their faith. What is it exactly that 29% of Southern Baptists are having a problem with here? So on one level, you know, it seems like the Southern Baptists are doing pretty well. But if I were a leader in the SBC, I would be very concerned about the 29% who don't affirm those statements. Only 51% of non-denominational pastors will affirm all eight of those statements. Only 44% of Pentecostal charismatic pastors, only 35% of pastors in African American churches will affirm all eight of those statements. Now, here's where it becomes a bit more troubling to me. It's when it starts applying to youth, when we start thinking about youth within our church culture. The current statistic for adults within evangelical Christian churches, and those are, you know, the conservative Bible-believing ones, is 33% of adults within evangelical Christian churches will affirm all of those statements. Only one-third. So statistically, if you go to a typical Christian Missionary Alliance or Calvary Chapel or Southern Baptist or E-Free or, you know, one of these conservative evangelical churches, two-thirds of the people that are adults sitting in the congregation will not affirm all eight of those statements. I mean, so I think that's really telling. I think it tells us a significant amount about the spiritual condition of the church. But where it really becomes troubling is when it comes to the youth. Because according to George Barna, only 11% of youth who are in church today under the age of 18 will affirm all of those statements. Only 11%. A few years back, Ken Ham hired a research group called the Beamer Group. And the Beamer Group did a study of young people who were in the church today, attending church with their parents, or at least just attending church. And they asked them, do you believe that church will have a part in your life when you are an adult? And 66% said, no, church will not have be a part of my life after I'm old enough to make up my mind. I am out of here. The only reason I go to church is because my parents make me. So 66% of those who are still in church say, I am leaving as soon as I possibly can. This is why Ken wrote a book that I have on the table back there called Already Gone, because he was saying these children are in the building. Their body is in the building, but their hearts and minds are already gone. And the reason they're already gone is because 89% of them do not believe the most basic tenets of Christianity. They do not buy into this. 89% don't. In fact, 51% of all churched youth who are in church today believe that Jesus sinned at some point during his life. 51%. 51% of all youth in church today believe that Jesus did not rise from the dead. So 65% of all youth in church today do not believe the Holy Spirit is a real entity. So here's a question for you. If you're going to church, you believe that Jesus sinned during his time on earth as a man, that he didn't rise from the dead, and the Holy Spirit is a myth, why would you want to go to church? Personally, I can't think of any reasons why you would want to go to church if you believe that those things were not true. So the question then is, if only 11% of churched youth, those who are in church today, buy into the most basic tenets of the Christian faith, what happened to the other 89% and why don't they buy in? So this has been something that I have studied and that I've struggled to understand for 20 years. And I've done a lot of research on this and a lot of thinking on it. And I travel around and I speak at churches and I meet lots of church leaders and I talk to people who are in churches and I spend time with families. And I think I've figured out some of this. And I guess what I have determined is in order for somebody to, you know, buy into a belief system, they have to have respect for the people who are promoting the belief system. If you don't trust the people who are promoting a belief system, you're not going to buy in. And so there's a certain level of trust that is required. And what I'm seeing is that the young people who are in church today have not been predominantly, primarily influenced by the values of the pastor. They've not been predominantly influenced by the values of their parents. They've been influenced by a very different belief system, by a very different value system than the Christian faith. So how is it that this generation of young people have been more influenced by a different value system than that of their church and their family? So what I started to do is started to think about the topic of influence. How is it that someone gains influence in a relationship with another person? And I've come to believe that there are two dominant forces in influence. So number one, in order to have influence in another person's life, you have to spend time with them. That, I think, is the most essential. The number one criteria for influence is time. So that's number one. Number two is affirmation and encouragement. You have to invest positively into somebody's life if you want to have influence. So you have to spend time with them and you have to invest positively. So when it comes to the parenting paradigm, if you want to have influence in the life of your child, you have to spend more time with your child than anyone else, and you have to encourage and affirm them more than anyone else in their life. And if you do that, what you're doing is you're buying influence. If you don't do that, then someone else is going to occupy that space because something always fills a void. So if you aren't occupying that space, something else will come in and fill it. So I started to think about years ago about the life of a child, and I started to think about what is it that owns their time? If time is the dominant force and influence, who owns their time? So I created a pie chart and basically said, let's look at the average day of a young person and how their time gets spent. So for about 85% to 90%, somewhere in there, 85 to 90% of all students in America, they go to a government school. They say statistically that only 3%, 2 to 3% of all students in the United States today are homeschooled. So that being the case, you're looking at about 97% of students who are in a school. But for about 85 to 90% of them, they're in a government-run school. So that's a big part of their day. You're looking at about 7 to 7.5 hours a day that they're in school. In one sense, that may not seem like an awful lot of time, but when you add that time up over kindergarten through 12th grade, it actually comes to, at the very minimum, and in Ohio, this would be true. Your school system requires 900 hours of teaching instruction. So it would be 10,800 seat hours of instruction between kindergarten and 12th grade. 10,800 hours. Now, this became really real to me when I read a book by a New York Times bestselling author named Malcolm Gladwell. He, as far as I know, is not a Christian. I've heard some rumors that he may be moving towards Christianity. I hope that's certainly true. But he's a sociologist, and he studies cultural trends. And one of his books that he wrote called Outliers, he talked about the power of 10,000 hours in becoming an expert in something. And he gave many different illustrations of Olympic athletes and classical musicians and people who became the best in the world at what they did. And he said, each one of these people put in over 10,000 hours of practice in their skill before they ever really became recognized nationally for what they did. He used the example of the Beatles, how they left Liverpool and they went to Germany in the early 1960s, I believe in 1962, and they spent 2 years in Germany practicing and playing in little pubs and clubs, and they logged over 10,000 hours of practice and performance in Germany before they ever hit Shea Stadium. And so by the time they hit the Ed Sullivan Show and Shea Stadium, they had a sound like no one had ever heard because they had put 10,000 hours into their craft. You know, you look at guys like here in Ohio, I should use LeBron James, the basketball player. He spent more than 10,000 hours dribbling and shooting a basketball before he graduated high school. So when you spend 10,000 hours, you become an expert in something. Well, when a student spends 10,000 hours in an anti-Christian humanist school system, they become an expert in humanism. They become an expert in the things that they're taught. They become an expert in evolution. They become an expert in ethical relativism. And those beliefs, those values become dominant for them. Since time is the number one force and influence, it's very important, it's very crucial that parents find a way to buy back as much time as they possibly can if they want to have influence in the life of their child. So the schooling is a huge factor in terms of the beliefs of youth. But the next part of the pie chart that I thought was interesting is they have 7 to 8 hours a day in school. But after that, sociologists tell us and researchers tell us that they consume, that this is the average young person under 18, they consume today 7.5 hours of digital multimedia every day of their life in a time block. So they go to school and they've got, let's just make it 7.5 hours a day of schooling, and then 7.5 hours after school in multimedia. And it actually is worse than that. It actually is 10.5 hours of information that is compressed into a 7.5 hour time space because of multitasking. So they're actually plugged into more than one information stream at a time. In other words, they're watching television, but they're texting their friends. Or they're on Facebook, but they're listening to their iPod. So they have two information streams coming in at the same time. So when you factor for multitasking, it's 10.5 hours of information compressed into a 7.5 hour time span every single day. So 7.5 hours of school, which for 85 to 90% of all churched youth is anti-Christian in its orientation, not religiously neutral, but opposed to the tenets of Christianity. Then you have 7.5 hours of multimedia after school that is also antagonistic to Christianity. It's not neutral. And what's interesting to me is that George Barna says that only 8% of churched youth have a different media palette than their non-Christian friends. So 92% of all Christian youth are watching exactly the same movies, listening to the same music, playing the same video games, involved in all the same social media experiences, all the same video games, all of those things. They have the same exact media palette as their non-Christian, atheist, and agnostic friends. So they're being informed by Hunger Games and Katy Perry and Lady Gaga and Eminem, and all, just like in the same way that their non-Christian friends are. Only 8% have a different media palette. So the vast majority of the dominance of their day, if you just think about it, 15 hours a day is comprised of anti-Christian information that they're soaking up like sponges in that kindergarten through 12th grade age. And for some reason, Christian parents think, oh, well, that's not going to affect them. For some reason, Christian parents think they can consume 20 to 25,000 hours of anti-Christian indoctrination, and it will have no effect. It's having an effect. It's having an effect to the point that only 11% of church youth believe the most basic tenets of the Christian faith, and 2/3 say, as soon as I'm an adult, I'm out of here. Some years ago, probably a decade ago now, Josh McDowell wrote a book called The Last Christian Generation. And he was talking about a generation called the millennials. So sociologists have designated age groups this way within the United States. You have the baby boomers who were born between 1946 and 1964. Then you have my generation, Generation X, which is born between 1965 and 1978. Okay, so that's the Gen X generation. And then you have the millennials who were born between 1978 and 1980, and 2000. So between 1978 and 2000 are the millennials. And then you have the generation that's born in the year 2000, or 2001 and after. The generation that's born after 2000, they don't have a designation yet. We don't know what they'll be. It could be Generation Z. It could be, you know, they could have some kind of a designation. But for now, the focus that you hear people talking about all the time is this millennial generation, because the millennials, they are kind of the future, right? Well, Josh McDowell called the millennial generation the last Christian generation that America would ever see. Because Josh has done all this research as well. He knows all the trends from, you know, Pew Research, Institute of Ethics, the Josephson Institute of Ethics, Nehemiah Institute, Barna Group, Beamer Group, all these different research groups. They all basically, Lifeway Christian Resources, they all have sort of the same information. And so Josh was saying that the generation that comes after the millennials, those born after 2000, they will not be merely non-Christian. That generation will be anti-Christian in their orientation. They will actually be hostile to Christianity. The millennial generation tends to be more apathetic than anything. In fact, they have a new term for them. They call them, many of them, nuns. N-O, not N-U-N, but N-O-N-E. And that's that they have no religion. They have no affinity for any kind of belief system or value system. They're not atheist. They're not agnostic. They're not Christian. They're not Buddhist. I'm just a nothing. I don't believe anything about anything, and I don't care about anything. So the millennial generation is what Josh McDowell was saying was the last Christian generation that America would see. Well, how Christian is the millennial generation? Well, Barna did this survey 10 years ago. Basically, in 2006, he did this survey, and he asked a lot of different kinds of people, but he asked people who were between the ages of 18 and 23, do you affirm these statements? And among those who are 18 to 23 in the United States in 2006, anybody want to guess? I'll show you this page so you can see some of these numbers. Anybody want to guess what percentage of 18 to 23-year-olds in America would affirm all eight of those statements? Okay, 15%. Good guess. Any other guesses? Okay, 5%. We have a 2%. Anybody want to go for like an 80 or 90? Oh, okay. Well, you know, it's always where there's always an optimist somewhere in the group, you know. So in 2006, of those 18 to 23, 6%. Of Americans between 18 and 23 affirmed all eight of those statements. He did it again a decade later, same eight questions, same age group, a decade later. Do you think that in 10 years' time, Americans between 18 and 23 became more Christian or less Christian in their beliefs? What do you think? Would anybody say more Christian? Anybody say less Christian? Okay. Unfortunately, they did become less Christian. So the question is, how much less Christian can you get than 6%? So here's the scary part. As of 2016, among 18 to 23-year-olds in the United States, less than one half of 1% of 18 to 23-year-olds in the United States right now will affirm all eight of those statements. Less than one half of 1%. Statistically, you really can't go much lower than less than one half of 1%. That is about statistically about as low as a country can go. So what I did is I actually pulled some international demographic information from Patrick Johnstone's Operation World and some other missions organizations that talk about Christian faith and demographics in other countries. And I found that there is more Christian belief in almost every other nation in the world right now than there is in the United States right now among 18 to 23-year-olds. In fact, you can go to the Scandinavian European countries, which have always been very godless, Denmark and Sweden and Norway and Finland and those countries, you know, just very godless countries. You will find a higher percentage of Christian belief in those countries than you will in the United States among 18 to 23-year-olds right now. You can go to any communist nation in the world and find a higher percentage of belief among 18 to 23-year-olds in every communist nation in the world than you will in the United States right now among 18 to 23-year-olds. Communist China, North Korea, former Soviet Union, any one of those countries, higher percentage of Christian belief among 18 to 23-year-olds than America right now. You can go to, this is the hard part, you can go to almost any Islamic nation in the world and find a higher percentage of Christian belief in those countries. There are only three nations in the world that are below the U.S., in terms of Christian belief among 18 to 23-year-olds. They're all Islamic. But there are like somewhere between 7 and 10 major Islamic nations that have a higher percentage of Christian belief than we do right now among 18 to 23-year-olds. So Josh McDowell was saying 10 years ago that the millennial generation, and this is the younger end right now, the 18 to 23-year-olds, that's the young end of that millennial generation. He's saying that generation is the last Christian generation America will ever see. And he was very clear. He said, I'm not speaking this prophetically. I'm not saying this is a word from God. He said, I'm not saying that. I'm saying statistically, if you watch the trends, you can't come back from this statistically. There's not a way to roll this back apart from some kind of a massive move of God that is completely inexplicable and unexpected. Which, you know, could happen, and it has happened at times and points in human history. But apart from that, you actually can't reverse this trend. You actually can't rewind. We'll never go back to Leave It to Beaver days. So basically what has happened is it's like we're in a vehicle, and we've been careening toward a cliff for a very, very long time. And what has happened is we've actually driven off the cliff. And we don't realize it as a church culture because we haven't had impact yet. Right now, we have this wonderful, peaceful moment of silence. And it feels very safe as we float. And what we're doing in our churches is we're looking around in the church and we're seeing young people. We're seeing children in the church and we're saying, there's not a crisis. There's not a problem. We have lots of young people in our churches. What we don't realize is that in their heart and mind, they're already gone. And the prediction that the Beamer Group made in the Already Gone study, that 66% are saying we're going to leave the church, it's actually accurate for what they're doing. Of every major church group that has been studied and polled, at least, at the minimum, 60% of their youth have left the church. Every denomination has at least 60%. The PCA, the Presbyterian Church in America, that's the conservative, reformed group of the Presbyterian Church. They say they're losing 65% of their youth. They leave the church somewhere around their high school graduation and say, we're never coming back. The Assemblies of God say they're losing 65% of their youth that leave the church somewhere around high school graduation and say, we're never coming back. The denomination that is losing the most, ironically, is the one that affirms these statements the most among their pastors. It's the Southern Baptist Convention. The Southern Baptist Convention is, according to the Southern Baptist Council on Family Life, is currently losing 88% of all of their youth leave the church somewhere around their high school graduation and say, we're never coming back. I was actually at the Southern Baptist Convention some years ago when this study first came out, and they were talking about the fact they were losing 88% of their youth, and some mathematician had done the math on this and discovered that the SBC was about to go from being the largest evangelical denomination in the United States with something like 8 million U.S. members to, by the year 2040, at this rate of loss, someone calculated that they would only have 600,000 members left in the SBC by the year 2040. They've driven off the cliff. There's not a way to come back from that. What was interesting was some of the pastors and delegates at that conference wanted to talk about the issue of them losing their youth, and the top brass of the SBC, most of them didn't want it discussed. So at the Southern Baptist Convention, if you want to bring an issue to the floor, it works a little bit like our U.S. representatives or state legislature process, where you introduce a resolution to the SBC, it goes to a committee, the committee talks about it, decides whether they want to release it to the floor for a vote. And if the committee passes the resolution, it goes out to the General Assembly for a vote, and then they decide whether they're going to ratify this resolution or not. Does that make sense? So that year, there were pastors and delegates who were trying to submit a resolution for addressing this issue of losing their Christian youth in the church. And the committee kept denying it and saying, we don't want to talk about that. We don't want that discussed. We don't want that brought up. And they kept passing, introducing and passing these really inane resolutions that were kind of nothing resolutions, in my opinion. Like, for example, one of them was, we as Southern Baptists resolve that we should all pray more. Anyone protest? Okay, resolution passes. You know, they had another one that was a resolution that we as Southern Baptists should evangelize more. Any objections? Okay, resolution passes. Well, one way that you can actually get your issue heard at the SBC, I'm not part of the Southern Baptist Convention. I was actually there with the media that particular year, but I was present at the conference. And anyway, one way you can get your message heard is you can write an amendment to the resolution. Just like if there's a bill that gets passed, you can write an amendment. And if the bill gets passed, your amendment passes, right? So if you get an amendment attached to a resolution and the resolution passes, then you get 2 minutes as a delegate to stand up and speak to your issue. So this happened with this evangelism resolution. And this one very brave delegate stood up and he said, I want to know what we're going to do about the loss of 88% of our youth within the church. He said, because basically it's like we have a hole in the bottom of our boat and we're drowning. Our denomination is hemorrhaging from the inside. We're losing a whole generation of youth. And I want to know what the SBC leadership says we should do about it. And the then president of the SBC, who was at the podium at the moment, he was not happy, visibly not happy that this came up. And his response was, okay, this has been attempted to be brought up all day. I will speak to this one time and then we're done. And we will not talk about this again. But he says, you want to know what we will do? Here is what our strategy is. Here's our game plan. We, as the Southern Baptist Convention, are going to increase our efforts in foreign evangelism. And through increased efforts in foreign evangelism, we are going to increase our numbers globally so that while the U.S. Southern Baptist Convention will lose members, and he said, that's a given. That will happen, and we just have to accept that. Globally, the SBC numbers should stay the same. So that's our plan, and we're not going to talk about this again. Now, I don't know how that hits you. I don't know how that strikes you. I don't know if that sounds like a good plan or not. There are a couple of problems I have with it. Number one, no church, no denomination, no missions group has ever in the history of Christian missions evangelized successfully at a rate that they would be able to reproduce an 88% fallout of their own youth. So it's just not feasible. It's not possible, statistically speaking. So it's not really a reasonable strategy. But secondly, let's suppose that it was. Let's suppose that somehow theoretically you could do it and you could replace the fallout of 88% of your own children. Basically, look at it this way. If you have 10 children, you're going to lose 9 of them to the world. Or if you have 5 children, you're going to lose 4 of them to the world. And the SBC is basically saying, okay, we're just going to concede that. Like that's okay. There's, you know, that's a given. That's just going to happen. But But we're going to go reach the lost in other countries across the world, and our numbers will stay the same. I don't want to say that this SBC president does not care about the youth within their own churches and denominations, but it sounds an awful lot like he doesn't care, just being honest. And one of the things that he mentioned is he said, you know, I've heard some people suggesting that we need to abandon public schools in favor of Christian schools and homeschooling. He said, I just want to speak to that for a moment as well. He said, the fact is, the time has not yet come. The schools are not yet bad enough. The schools are not yet bad enough. We need to stay there. We need to keep our children there to be salt and light. I mean, this is coming from a guy who's losing 88% of all the youth in his church, and he is totally committed to the status quo. And this is one of the things that bothers me about a lot of the church leadership and a lot of the church denominations. It seems to me that their primary concern is maintain the status quo at all cost, and that at no point can we ever change the paradigm. It's in my mind, I think of it like this. It's like they're on a train and their intent is they want to go north. The problem is they're on a southbound train. So their solution is to go north. We are going to run as fast as we know how in a northerly direction on a southbound train, and that's how we're going to get north. The problem is that will never work. In order for you to go north, at a certain point, you actually have to get off the train you're on and say, let's find a train that goes north, get on the train that goes north, and head that direction. That's the only way you will ever go north. But what I see is a tenacious commitment to never changing the status quo. We are going to do things the way we have always done them until we die. That is our commitment. It's not working, and we're losing an entire generation of young people, and it's not okay. And it keeps me up at night. I'm desperately concerned about this because we haven't felt the impact of it, but you don't have to go far to see what that looks like. I mean, you go to Europe and you look at what happened in these countries where we just celebrated the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. You know, October 31st, 1517, when Martin Luther pounded the 95 Theses on the door at Wittenberg, the fires of the Reformation burned brightly in Switzerland, in Germany, in Holland, in England. You go to those countries today, the church buildings over there aren't even used as churches anymore. They're used as taverns. They're used as antique stores. In fact, a lot of them are used as museums where you can pay $10 and have a docent take you through and do basically a mock church service to show you what it used to be like when people would go to church. That's how far those countries that 500 years ago were the seedbed of the Reformation, all the great revivals that happened in Europe and the awakenings here in the United States, the missionary movement, all of that, it's so unchurched there now that they don't even know what a church service looks like. They'll go pay 10 bucks and have a docent take them on a museum tour and literally walk through a liturgy of what a church service used to be like. And so this SBC pastor says, the time has not yet come. The schools are not yet bad enough. This is the thing that infuriated me. I wish that I had an opportunity to be able to stand up and go, well, let me tell you something. In that pastor's church, in his district, okay? So that former president of the SBC, not the current president, several presidents ago, in that president's local school district, that same year, his local public school district that he claimed was full of Sunday school teachers and, you know, his church basically ran that school. It was basically like a Christian school in his mentality. His local school district had all these Christian teachers, Christian principals, Christian superintendents, Christian coaches, and so on, right? It's like infiltrated with Christians everywhere from our church. So see the influence we're having there. We're turning this church we're turning the school upside down for Jesus, right? That's what he was selling. In his local school district, earlier that year, the ACLU had sued the school and successfully won a lawsuit because they claimed that that school was in violation of the First Amendment supposed alleged wall of separation between church and state, which there is no such statement of wall of separation of church and state in the First Amendment. You guys probably know the history on that. That was a letter from Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptists, just assuring them that the government would not interfere in church polity. That was when he used in a private letter to the Danbury Baptists in Connecticut. That was what he was saying, is the church will not interfere with religious freedom. That was, well, that's what that phrase meant. But it was not in the First Amendment. It's not in the Constitution. But anyway, the ACLU alleged there was a violation of this wall of separation of church and state, and that there was an establishment of religion in the public school. So what was it? When I first heard about this case, I thought, what was it that the school did? I thought, well, maybe the teachers were initiating prayer. Maybe a coach had had a prayer with a football team before the game. Maybe somebody had a Ten Commandments on their wall. Maybe somebody had a Bible on their desk. You know, the typical stuff the ACLU always gets in on, right? That the school is establishing religion in some way. No, the offense was that during the holiday time in the cafeteria at the school, the school was using red and green napkins in the cafeteria. And the ACLU sued the school and forced them to remove the red and green napkins because that was an establishment of religion. The use of red and green napkins was an establishment of religion. Why? Because it represented what holiday? Christmas. Christmas is a Christian holiday, so they were forcing religious dogma on those students in the cafeteria during school time. And that school, in the school district of that SBC president's church in that area, that school had to remove red and green napkins from their cafeteria because it was too much Jesus. Red and green napkins were too much Jesus for that guy's local public school. And he's saying, the time has not yet come. The schools are not yet bad enough. Well, how bad do they have to get? You can't even have a red and green napkin. How much less Jesus could you possibly have? I mean, what exactly is he waiting for? 88% fallout is not enough. What's he want, 98%? In my mind, I cannot understand the priority structure of these pastors that they think that maintaining the status quo at all costs is acceptable. That pastor has the largest, most, not the largest, but the most expensive church building in the United States. They've spent over $150 million on their church building. $150 million church building this pastor has, and his local public school can't even have red and green napkins. And they're losing 88% of their youth, and he's saying, we just need to keep doing what we're doing. It's fine. Don't worry. Everything's okay. The priority structure is so messed up. So how do we get out of this? Okay, so here's how we got here. The way that we got here was by parents delegating 15 hours a day to anti-indoctrination systems and saying, we want a government education system and we want a secular media to raise our children. We want Hollywood. We want the music industry. We want the gaming industry. We want them to raise our children. And we just want to be able to work our jobs and not be hindered and not be bothered. That's the mentality, unfortunately, of the church, not the world, the church. So in this pie chart, 15 hours a day with these students, where do parents fit into that? Well, I looked at two different studies. One of them said the average parent today spends 19 minutes a day interacting with his or her child. Only 19 minutes a day because, and that's true for both men and women now because both parents work. There was another study that said 200 minutes a week is the average that a parent spends interacting with his or her child. So I got my calculator out and I totaled that and it comes to approximately 17 minutes a day. So two different studies. One says 19 minutes a day, one says 17 minutes a day. You know, I can do the math. I looked at that. I said, man, somebody's lying. You know, these both can't be true, right? The law of non-contradiction. 19 minutes, 17 minutes. Somebody's lying here. Truth is probably in the middle somewhere. It's like 18 minutes and 23 seconds a day is probably what the average parent is spending with their child a day. And so you look at 15 hours a day of anti-Christian indoctrination up against 18 minutes a day. Who's going to win? If time is the most significant factor in influence, who's going to win that battle? I guarantee you in almost every situation, the parent will not win. The parent will not be the most influential, most important person in their child's life. They can't be. They just don't have enough time. So if I ask these parents who spend 19 minutes a day with their child, why do you only spend 19 minutes a day with your child? What would they tell me? I'm too busy. Too busy. I have to work. I don't have enough time. So here's the real killer question. Is it true? Is it true that they're too busy and that they only have 19 minutes a day to spend with their children? Is that true? I'm seeing people saying no. I'm gonna put it two ways. I'm gonna say yes and no. In one sense, yes, because of two problems. Number one, their value system, the way that they've structured their life, their number one pursuit in life, unfortunately, is not the pursuit of the kingdom of God. As much as they say it is, as much as they would like to think that it is in their own mind, and as much as they want to convince other people it is, it's not. Their number one priority in life is the pursuit of the American dream. And that's what their whole educational system was about, was training them and equipping them and preparing them to be able to chase the American dream. And it's what their parents drilled into them. It's what their grandparents drilled into them, their teachers. You're an American. You can have it all. You can live it all. You can soak it up. Just do it. You know, this is your moment. Live before you die. That's part of it. The other thing is, in pursuit of the American dream, they have gotten themselves into debt to a point that they are so overcome and overwhelmed by debt that they don't have the ability to make the best choices for their family because financially, they literally can't afford to. Now, that's a lifestyle that they've gotten into. And a huge part of that, I mean, I could go on for days with this, but a huge part of that is even this god of college and university that we have all bought into, that you got to go get a college degree no matter what. I was just studying this. Only 27% of people in the United States use their college degree. That means 3/4 of the people who spent tens of thousands of dollars, or in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars on college debt, 3/4 of them aren't even using their degree. But beyond that, basically what I would say is on the time factor, two things. Number one, you have to fight debt like it is your mortal enemy and it wants to kill you, because it is. It is your enemy. Having debt keeps you from being able to make the best decisions for your family. My wife and I have 9 children. We homeschool our children. The reason that we're able to homeschool 9 children and I'm able to travel around the country and do free seminars for parenting, on parenting for people and speak in churches, the reason I can do this is because we don't have debt. It's important for you to fight debt with everything you have in you so that you can make the best choices for your children. So is it true? On one level, because of priorities and because of a lifestyle and a worldview that we've bought into, yeah, we've backed ourselves into a corner. You know, we've created a scenario where we don't have the time to be able to spend that we should. And we need to figure out how to get out of that. We need to figure out how to buy back that time. But then finally, the same group of researchers that tells us what the media consumption for young people is tells us that parents today spend 2.5 hours every night of their life watching television and or Netflix. 2.5 hours every night watching TV or some kind of online programming. And that does not include social media. Just 2.5 hours a night of TV and social media. So these parents who spend 19 minutes a day with their children and say, I don't have enough time to spend with my children, they actually have 2.5 hours a night of discretionary time that they choose to not invest in the children, but to invest in themselves. And here's the problem. Children are smart. Children can do the math. Children know when they're getting the short end of the deal. They hear mom and dad saying, I don't have more time than 19 minutes a day to invest in my children. But they watch mom and dad spend 2.5 hours watching television every night, having me time. They know where they fall. They put it on the scale and they say, mom and dad have 2.5 hours for themselves. They have 19 minutes a day for me. I know where I fall in the scheme of things. And this generation of young people who are getting 15 hours a day of anti-Christian indoctrination through a humanistic school system and through a secular media and getting 19 minutes a day of their parents are choosing to walk away from the Christian faith. So what is the silver bullet? What is the hope? What is the approach that the parents have decided? This is the thing that is going to make sure my children become Christian. They have a plan. I just want you to know that. This generation of Christian parents is not without a strategy. They have a backup plan. Even though they're spending 19 minutes a day with their children, their children are getting 25,000 hours of anti-Christian indoctrination between kindergarten and 12th grade. They think that their 19 minutes a day and one other thing is going to balance the scale. What's the one other thing that they have? What is the silver bullet? What is the magic pill that's going to fix this problem and ensure that their children grow up to be Christians with a biblical worldview? VBS, Sunday School, Children's Church, Youth Group. We're going to make sure that they are in church at least 1 hour a week, maybe two or three. And that is going to compensate for 15 hours a day of anti-Christian indoctrination. How well do you think that works? There's a couple problems with that. I'm going to try to speed up here. I don't know if you can tell, I'm kind of passionate about this topic. Do you know what the number one best-selling Sunday school curriculum in the world has been for the last 20 years? If you just go over the last 20 years, what the dominant number one best-selling Sunday school curriculum in the world has been? It's not David C. Cook. It's not Group Publishing. It's not Standard Publishing. It's not Lifeway. It's not Answers in Genesis. It's VeggieTales. Exactly. VeggieTales is the number one best-selling Sunday school curriculum over the past 20 years. And what parents don't know is that is the go-to for church leaders. I did children's ministry for a while, years ago. I did youth ministry and children's ministry. What parents don't understand is our goal in children's ministry is basically to keep your child alive for 1 hour. And if we succeed in doing that, it's been a really good week. Now, you know, I understand that parents think that, well, you know, all of this 10,800 seat hours of anti-Christian indoctrination in government schools and 15,000 hours of multimedia, secular multimedia, you know, that's maybe it's not the best. But, you know, if we can get them to watch Joshua throwing orange slushies off the wall of Jericho, that's going to compensate for all of that. And that's going to equip them that when they meet that university professor, that philosophy, psychology, sociology professor, their freshman year of college, that's going to turn the tide. It's not. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but of freshmen who go, so how many young people make it all the way through high school with their faith intact? So basically, only 11% basically have a biblical worldview, according to, will affirm, well, I'll show you, you didn't see this slide. Only 11% of church youth will affirm these eight statements by the time they graduate. Only 11%. So you're talking about pretty much a complete annihilation of a whole generation of church youth. But when they get to college, of those who say, I'm a Christian going into college, how many of them say I'm a Christian at the end of their freshman year? Any guesses? 30%. So of all the students who go into college saying, I'm a Christian, only 30% come out their freshman year saying, I'm still a Christian. The rest have abandoned their faith after their freshman year of college. So you're talking about anywhere from 60 to 88% who say, I'm not even a Christian at the end of high school, depending on the church denomination. Anywhere from 60 to 88% who say, I'm not even a Christian anymore. And then of those who enter college, by the end of the freshman year, only 30% of those say, I'm still a Christian at the end of the freshman year. We're going to have to do something more significant than what we've been doing if we want to see a change. So what's the change? We'll end on this. What is it that we need to do differently? I'm going to suggest something really radical. I'm going to suggest that if you want your children to be discipled in the Christian faith, it is not sufficient for you to assume that the church will get it done for you, because it's not happening and it won't happen.
Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek him.